Hi, and welcome to this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I'm Frankie Goldfarb, and for the next hour, I will be reading from the April 7th, 2024 issue. The first article is the cover story, and it is titled, Ex-National Enquirer Editor Tells All. Inside the tabloid empire, at the center of the Manhattan DA's case against Donald Trump. And it's by Lachlan Cartwright. On Tuesday, April 4th, 2023, I was outside Manhattan Criminal Court. It was a sunny spring day, and the Secret Service and the police department had blocked off the streets with barricades. The sidewalks were clogged with news crews from around the world. Supporters of Donald Trump roamed a pen that was set up to house them. Eventually, the former president was rushed out of the courthouse after being charged by Alvin Bragg, the district attorney of Manhattan, with 34 counts of falsifying business records. His convoy departed to cheers from fans. I pulled up the indictment and the statement of facts on my iPhone. At the center of the case is the accusation that Trump took part in a scheme to turn the National Enquirer and its sister publications into an arm of his 2016 presidential campaign. The documents detailed three hush money payments made to a series of individuals to guarantee their silence against potentially damaging stories in the months before the election. Because this was done with the goal of helping his election chances, the case implied these payments amounted to a form of illegal, undisclosed campaign spending. And Bragg argued, because Trump created paperwork to make the payments seem like regular legal expenses, that amounted to a criminal effort at a cover-up. Trump has denied the charges against him. The documents rattled off a number of seedy stories that would have been right at home in a venerable supermarket tabloid had they actually been published. The subjects were made anonymous, but recognizable to anyone who had followed the story of Trump's entanglement with the Enquirer. His affair with the porn star Stormy Daniels, of course, was at the heart of it. There was also Karen McDougal, the Playboy Playmate of the Year in 1998, whose affair with Trump was similarly made to disappear. The payments for the rights to her story made to look like fees for writing a fitness column and appearing on magazine covers. Trump has denied involvement with both women. There were others that were lesser known too, like Dino Sanjuin, a former Trump World Tower doorman who claimed that Trump had a love child with one of the building's employees. The story was never published, and Sajudin was paid $30,000 to help keep quiet about it. For me, reading the indictment was like stepping through the looking glass, because it described a three-year period in my own professional life, one that I have come to deeply regret. Dino, the doorman? During my time at America Media Incorporated, also known as AMI, the Enquirer's parent company, I was one of the editors pushing our reporters to confirm that story. McDougal's fitness columns were published only after I instructed a colleague to work with the model to put them together. These were all pretty normal things to do during my time there, a life-changing detour in my career, which happened to coincide with a bizarre period at AMI, when it was allegedly enlisted in some ways that I saw and in others that I didn't, into the service of helping Trump become president. Now, as a former president faces a criminal trial for the first time in American history, I am forced to grapple with what really happened at the Inquirer in those years, and whether and how I can ever set things right. In a sense, it was Philip Seymour Hoffman who got me the job. In February 2014, while I was working at the Daily News, an editor there told me that Hoffman had been found dead in his West Village apartment. He asked for my help on the story. Our crime reporters tracked down the name of the person who had found the body, David Barr Katz, a close friend of Hoffman's and a playwright, but all our attempts to reach him had not borne fruit. Soon, the National Enquirer hit the newsstands with an exclusive interview with Katz. That's in quotes. He says that he and Hoffman were homosexual lovers and that he had watched Hoffman freebase cocaine the night before his death. The story quickly unraveled. The Enquirer had been talking to a David Katz, but this one was a freelance TV producer based in New Jersey. After being bombarded with calls from reporters and consuming several beers, he later told the New York Post, he apparently decided to have some fun. The actual David Barr Katz sued AMI for $50 million. The magazine withdrew the story and settled out of court. In the end, the Inquirer took out a full-page ad in the New York Times acknowledging the error and paid Katz enough that he was able to establish an annual prize for playwrights in Hoffman's honor. David Pecker, the chief executive of AMI, removed the top editor. In his place, Pecker pulled a young editor named Dylan Howard over from another AMI publication called Radar Online. Howard and I met a few years earlier in New York. He attended the same university I did in Melbourne, although we weren't friends in Australia. Now, two Aussie journalists in New York, we swapped gossip and hit it off. I helped land one of his biggest scoops. In 2010, I passed Charlie Sheen's private cell number to him, and he figured out that texting Sheen when he was parting would get his attention. The two developed a rapport, and after a series of well-publicized meltdowns, Sheen invited Howard to Los Angeles to watch him take a drug test and reveal the results live on Good Morning America. In March 2014, Howard and I started talking about the possibility of my coming to the Inquirer as his number two. During a booze-fueled night at the Electric Room, a nightclub in the Meatpacking District, he walked me through the offer, a $60,000 bump in compensation, which worked out to be a 75% raise. and I would be running a national news operation with the resources he promised to break agenda-setting stories. I had never paid that much attention to the supermarket tabloids, but I knew enough to know what the Inquirer was. It published a sensational mix of celebrity scandal, true crime, and triumph over tragedy real-life stories. It might not have been a respected newspaper, especially because of its tendencies to print cover lines that stretch the truth to the breaking point. But it's not as if it published stories about that boy either. That's the Weekly World News. The Inquirer's reporters were fearless, and they did sometimes win the respect of the mainstream press. During the wrongful death suit brought against O.J. Simpson by the parents of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, it was the Inquirer's reporters who found photos of Simpson wearing Bruno Magli shoes, the type that left prints in blood at the scene of murders. The revelation helped the jury decide that Simpson could be held responsible for the deaths. By the time I started, the Inquirer's weekly newsstand sale figures hovered around 360,000, down from a high of about 4 million in the 1990s. Still, even in recent years, the Inquirer had broken big stories. In fact, the tabloid most likely altered the course of the 2008 presidential election when it exposed John Edwards' affair and love child with a campaign staff member. That investigation showed the muscle and drive of the Inquirer's reporting. Stakeouts, door knocks, the country. Persisting until they got the story right. Howard told me that he wanted the magazine to land ambitious stories like that. All things going well, he texted me a bit hyperbolically. You and I will be the youngest editors of a national U.S. publication ever. I was agonizing over the offer when the editor-in-chief of the Daily News, Colin Myler, called me into his office. Myler presented me with a $10,000 raise and thanked me for my work. I thought he might have caught wind of the job offer, so I mentioned it to him. He said I would be making a big mistake if I went to work for David Pecker. Deep down, I was hoping Myler would make a counteroffer, but he didn't. I took Howard on his word. Ultimately, my hubris sealed the deal. I started as executive editor of The Inquirer and Radar Online in mid-May. What I soon learned is that Howard, even if he wanted to, wouldn't be changing the operation. Pecker really ran the place. On Monday, Wednesday, and Friday evenings, there were cover meetings when Howard and the editors of the Inquirer's sister titles would go before Pecker and several of his top lieutenants to show a few options and analyze sales figures. If one title had a week-to-week decline, Pecker became apoplectic. I would walk through the back of the newsroom near Pecker's office and hear him screaming through the walls. Sometimes Pecker would suggest a preferred cover line, forcing us to twist a story to fit the language. In that paranoid environment, all anyone cared about was not incurring Pecker's wrath and being fired. Pecker did not respond to requests for comments. A frustrating first year spent in a windowless office was suddenly interrupted on the afternoon of March 29th, 2015, when a source told me about a woman named Ambra Batalani Gutaris, who went to the New York Police Department after being groped by Harvey Weinstein in Tribeca. My pulse was racing. Finally, a worthwhile scoop. There had been rumors about Weinstein and women for years. Affairs, the casting couch, and worse. I called Howard and was struck by his response. He seemed less interested in the story than in the identity of my source. In response to questions from the Times, Howard said he was simply vetting the story's sourcing, a routine part of his job duties. I could not figure out his attitude, but before we got further, the Daily News broke the story with the help of police sources. But Gutaris still hadn't spoken publicly, and Howard went into overdrive trying to buy her side of the story. The Inquirer, like many tabloids, sometimes paid sources for exclusive stories. This is not an acceptable practice in most newsrooms or in the ones I've worked in since. Still, it seemed odd that we were trying to buy a story that we could have had free. Cash, really no object, Howard messaged me, so I can sling your source $5,000 to get it done in addition to her $20,000. But Gutaris didn't want $20,000. She wanted her story heard. And it continued to roll out in other outlets through leaks from law enforcement and movie industry sources, who framed the matter in the media as a blackmail attempt. Howard was in and out of my office asking for updates. Quote, I think the stakes just increased, he texted me, and your source could earn some big bucks. Close quotes. I texted the source saying that Gutaris could ask for any amount of money and that the source could take a substantial cut. She's less concerned with money than with the right moves, the source responded. By the middle of the week, Howard told me to offer Gutaris $150,000 with a $25,000 finder's fee to my go-between, an extraordinary amount of money. Most stories we bought cost us maybe a few thousand dollars. Howard said he was merely conveying offers at the direction of Pecker. She says no, the source texted back, and don't ask again. Unknown to me at the time, Weinstein had all but secured a guarantee that we would never report on his sexual transgressions. Earlier that year, the Weinstein Company signed a deal with AMI to produce something called Radar TV. The plan was to take our celebrity coverage from Radar Online and use it to make a daily live TV show in the mold of Access Hollywood. The deal entailed a lot of lunches between Weinstein and Howard at Tribeca Grill, but never resulted in an actual TV show. Still, the partnership did make Weinstein a FOP, friend of Pecker, which entitled him to protection from negative coverage. He was also able to leverage his relationship with AMI to use our vast news gathering resources to collect dirt on the actresses who he thought might talk to the press. The New York Post, the Daily Mail, and other outlets painted Gutierrez as a gold digger who had attended the Bunga Bunga parties of Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi of Italy. Years later, that I learned that one of AMI's top lawyers had informed someone in the office of Cy Vance, the Manhattan District Attorney at the time, that Gutierrez was trying to sell her story to us. Vance's office eventually announced that it would not pursue charges against Weinstein. In the end, Gutierrez reached a settlement with Weinstein and went on to tell her story to the press. A couple of months later, Trump descended the escalator at Trump Tower. Editorial discussions about John Travolta, Lisa Marie Presley, and Bill Cosby were now interspersed with chatter about Hillary Clinton, Ted Cruz, and Marco Rubio. The headlines that resulted were not ambiguous. Quote, "Why I am the only choice for president, exclusive, Donald Trump writes for the Inquirer." And then in parentheses, he didn't. A colleague cobbled the piece together, and Michael Cohen, Trump's lawyer and go-between with AMI, got Trump's approval for it. Another headline, "Who's Chelsea's real dad? Prez hopeful, Hillary Clinton moment of truth, exclusive DNA test results, bombshell." In parentheses, "We had mounted an operation to collect Chelsea Clinton's trash in an effort to get her DNA. But because Clinton lived in a big Manhattan apartment building, it was virtually impossible to get access to her garbage, and we instead got a sample off a pen she used to sign a book. The results were inconclusive, but we published the story anyway." Another headline, "Hillary, 6 months to live. Cruel bill forces her to stay on campaign trail." These covers came with doctored images of Clinton looking frail, bolstered by quotes from anyone who would have the right things and who would say the right things and had a title that tenuously qualified him to offer an opinion. The Inquirer did employ real reporters who would comb through documents, cultivate sources, and use old-school reporting techniques. But I was coming to terms with the other side of the magazine, where a headline was chosen and editors and writers spun up a tenuous story to match. This all came on the heels of a family tragedy that made my job seem even more detestable and stupid. In the spring, my dad grew ill, and when he finally got to a doctor, irregularities were found in his blood. Stomach cancer, stage 4. He was told he had 3 months to live. I had a contentious relationship with him during my adolescence, and by 22, I had moved to London to pursue journalism. He and my mother would visit, but because I was gay and hiding this from them, it kept us distant. Soon after my younger brother came out, I asked my father how he was dealing with it. Quote, "It could be worse," he told me. "We could have two of them." When I finally came out several years later, my father took it in and asked me, "Are you sure you're not bi?" It took a few years, but he came to terms with having two sons who weren't straight. And by the time of his 70th birthday, he had visited me in New York and we ran around town like teenagers. He would tell me it was one of the best weeks of his life. I landed back in Melbourne just in time. When I had last seen my dad a few months earlier, he was a fit 71-year-old. Now the color had drained from his skin. His voice was hoarse as we hugged. Just 9 days after I landed, he was admitted to a palliative care facility. He was unconscious, but we talked to him as if he were lucid. We all slept in his room. I lay awake and listened as his breaths got further and further apart. Just after 5 a.m. on May 1st, 2015, he took his last. I buried my father and I returned to New York, dazed by grief. I cried in the shower before work. I sat blankly in editorial meetings. I don't know how I would have responded to the events that followed had I not been so depressed. But the truth is that I was. I was drinking heavily, and life felt hopeless. I was angry. I became lazy, even a little bit crazy. In the fall, we got a startling tip over the transom from a former doorman at Trump World Tower, who said that Trump had an affair with a woman who worked in the building and that she had given birth to a secret love child. The tip line was a lot of fun, but presenting its fair share of headaches. Because we advertised that we paid for stories, we got all types of chancers and charlatans trying their luck. So we proceeded cautiously, not only because of that, but also because we knew Trump was an FOP. Howard had to check with the boss before he could make any moves. The word came back that we could proceed, and we quickly signed the tipster, Dino Sajwin, to a source contract that would pay $30,000 if we ran his story. We assigned a team of reporters to firm it up. Before any calls were made, we wanted to ensure that we had photos of both the woman and the love child in hand in case we went to ground. That was the stakeout at the home of the woman. Another reporter was sent to the address of the love child. With photos of both secured, we arranged for Sajwin to sit for a polygraph. That was standard practice for stories that could draw legal action from the subject. We had two private investigators who would routinely conduct lie detector tests on sources before we ran their stories. It was an extra layer of insurance, especially because the Inquirer was a constant target of lawsuits. A polygraph could demonstrate that we had gone above and beyond to confirm that a source was telling the truth. We would sometimes spike stories when sources failed polygraphs, but over time, I came to feel that the tests were a cynical way of manufacturing a good faith effort before publication. Sajwin passed his polygraph, but it turned out that the information was secondhand. He had heard his colleagues talking about it, and he had no proof. He had serious credibility issues besides. If you ran his name through Google, you would find an anonymous website that accused him of making similar allegations about a Trump World Tower resident. I could hear from Howard's office that Michael Cohen was calling, and I assumed he was looking for updates. I had my doubts about the story, especially as the love adult, as I was now calling her, because she was in her late 20s, looked just like the man on her birth certificate who was not Donald Trump. Then out of nowhere, the order came to stand down. Pecker made the call to pay Sajjan $30,000, and the story was killed without Howard explaining why. It was an enormous amount of money to pay someone, especially for a story we weren't running. In December, a reporter met Sajjan at a McDonald's in Pennsylvania to present him with the check. In return, he signed a new contract that stipulated that if he told the story to any third parties, he would be on the hook for $1 million in damages to AMI. It was a highly unusual clause. The signed contract was put into a safe. A colleague who was working with me described what happened as a catch and kill. It was the first time I heard that phrase, but it would not be the last. As we hurtled towards the presidential primaries, there was laser focus on stories about Trump's rivals. Ben Carson, we alleged, had left a sponge in a woman's brain. Bernie Sanders, we accused, without any evidence, of being accused in a child sex probe. Marco Rubio, or at least someone with a similar haircut, had been photographed at a man-fest foam party. While I had serious misgivings about publishing stories like these, which took cues from the sites like InfoWars and Gateway Pundit, it also felt totally meaningless. Would anyone take this stuff seriously? I also quieted my conscience by continuing to drink heavily every night. Ted Cruz was a major target. We ran thinly sourced stories that suggested that he was a raging alcoholic who had five secret mistresses and was named in a Madam's Black Book. We ran a cover story linking his father, Raphael, to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The article hinged on a grainy photo contained in the Warren Commission report purporting to show Lee Harvey Oswald handing out pro-Castro flyers with Rafael Cruz. The money quote came from a guy who ran a photo digitalization website who told the reporters with, quote, a high degree of confidence that it was the same person. Then, much to everyone's surprise and my horror, the Cruz story was picked up by mainstream media. Trump went on Fox News to repeat the claims, and the Cruz campaign was forced to respond. I watched in Howard's office dumbfounded as Cruz denied the story on CNN. I was eventually moved into a better office, one that had windows and an old safe about the size of a mini fridge. The Sajjan contract was inside it, and I used it as a footrest. My old office, meanwhile, was littered with dozens of boxes that had been brought up from AMI's offices in Boca Raton, Florida. This was all the material the newsrooms had collected on the Clintons over the decades. I was directed to hire a freelance researcher to go through them and generate memos so that we could gin up hit pieces. The Inquirer had a similar archive of files on Trump, perhaps the most amazing trove of Trump material of any national news organization, but it was not receiving the same careful review. Instead, I was going through the memos from the freelancer that provided the basis for spurious stories accusing Hillary Clinton of forming a hit squad to kill Vince Foster. Then we moved on hyperbolic material on Bill Clinton and women. And here's one, quote, Hillary's hiding Bill's sex crimes. 36 women break their silence. And that cover landed in May 2016. Between these were a drumbeat of fictitious health crisis for the former First Lady and presidential candidate. With the help of so-called medical experts, typically publicity-hungry pundits who understood that what we wanted to hear, and the assistance of a talented art department, we tried to kill her off in print almost weekly. She would appear with her eyes made baggy and the colors in the images desaturated. In others, she swelled to fit the cover line that she had gained 103 pounds and was eating herself to death. In another, we purported to have her full medical file, which, as the cover screamed, said she had three strokes, Alzheimer's, liver damage from booze, and violent rages. We had another secret weapon, Michael Silvestri. By day, Silvestri worked at the Walt Disney Company, but at night he operated Truth and Deception Technologies in Florida. We would send Silvestri audio clips of politicians or celebrities speaking, and after using software that he called DecepTech Voice Stress Analysis, he sent back charts at $500 per test, such as Hillary failed secret FBI lie detector. That was one such cover. We had no reason to believe that deep tech had been used by the FBI. We went to him so often that I could signal that we required his service again by using a cranking hand motion. In August, Howard told me he had met with a former play-by-playmate named Karen McDougal, who said she had an affair with Trump. The woman was being represented by a lawyer, Keith Davidson, and Howard said he found her story credible. Howard told me that Pecker bought her story for $150,000, but it would never see the light of day. It was the second catch and kill on Trump's behalf that I had heard about. I started to avoid Howard as best as I could. Our interactions became icy, and colleagues in the newsroom started to notice. I felt as if I were being suffocated, and I feared that being near all of this would mean the end of my career. This is a very long article. I'm going to stop reading it now so we have time for another one. The next article is titled, Mr. Manners. Over 12 seasons of Curb Your Enthusiasm, Larry David has given us something more than laughs. It's a rule book of how not to live in society, and it's by Wesley Morris. Suppose you're out at brunch and find yourself in a buffet line that a fellow diner does not appear to have noticed. He casually approaches with his plate and tries to serve himself. Do you A, join the hangry mob, cursing him, or B, rise to this man's defense because you can see that he's holding a plate, which means he already waited in line and is now returning for another helping? Well, if you're Larry David, not only is the answer B, but the misunderstanding warrants in your scratchy Brooklyn accent a triumphant clarification. Quote, That's not how we do things here in America. We don't wait for seconds, never. Larry knows from buffet breaches. He once caught someone pulling what he termed a chat and cut, gaining proximity to food by talking to someone with a choicier position in line. He doesn't like it, but is impressed anyway. Quote, I respect your skills. Another time, when a restaurant employee accuses him of violating its buffet policy by sharing his plate with his manager and main man, Jeff, a lawyer magically appears to clarify for the employee that after a diner purchases a meal, what he does with it is his business. Justice and brunch have been served. But now let's suppose that you're a serious middle-aged woman named Marilyn, and you've decided to host dinner for your new beau's closest friends, and the guests include this Larry David, whom you've already had to shoo from the arm of one of your comfy chairs. The group raises a glass and toasts your hospitality. Well, everybody except you know who. Susie, who is married to Jeff and clearly finds Larry as much of an irritant as you've begun, asks, you can't clink Larry? You can't clink Larry? Why should he? Because it's a custom that people do, which is friendly and nice. That's in quotes. Larry takes a sip of water and asks the most peculiar question. What is this tap? It is. His response? Surprised you don't have a filter. Do you A, serve him your coldest glance and withering reply? You have no filter. Or B, ask him to leave your home. If you're Marilyn, you do both. These stories hail from Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is scheduled to deliver its final episode on April 7th, after 12 seasons and 24 years on HBO. In each incident, bald, bespeckled, wiry, wealthy Larry has stepped out of line, once physically to defend or offend. I went back and watched the whole series and would like to report that television has never had anything like this show. Nothing as uncouth and contradictory and unhinged, and yet somehow under a tremendous amount of thematic control. Nothing whose calamity doubles as a design for living. It presents the American id at war with its puritanical superego. Sometimes Larry is the one, sometimes he's the other, and the best episodes dare him to inhabit the two at once, heretic and Talmudist. Even people who don't watch the show, and that's most of the country, seem to know the gist, that Larry, as performed by Larry David, is a monstrously entitled crank, the Godzilla of Western Los Angeles. But Curb Your Enthusiasm is about more than Larry's probable narcissism. It is a supreme comedy of manners. Howard asks, do we share a meal? A drive, a party, a meeting, a bathroom, an office pantry, a city. How do we courteously enforce norms and with modesty uphold standards? Are courtesy and modesty necessary? It's the only show we have left that's been this curious about, this keen on the fine print of Living an Ethical Civic Life, about interpersonal candor and the maintenance of a kind of civility while also allowing for the liberty of letting you do you. Larry makes Liberty want to drink. He is insensitive, selfish, monomaniacal, prone to flagrance, frequently wrong in every single way a person can be wrong, by accident, via misunderstanding, out of malice. He can be a bad friend and has been a lousy husband, a worse boyfriend, a dubious lay, and an iffy boss. Don't go into business with Larry or tell him a secret. Don't invite him to your funeral. Don't rely on him to watch your newsstand so you can pee. Probably don't be his co-star or co-author either. I've never seen any actor with David's grasp of how to play skepticism for laughs. Eyebrows as up-yanked drawbridge, forehead creases as lasagna of vexation. That raw-boned voice of his soars, if not in octaves, then certainly with tickly, prickly dynamism. He can shout down anyone for insinuation or seduction, or for seductive insinuation, he can drop it low. David has imbued Larry with so much guilt, exceptionalism, cluelessness, terror, cowardice, innocence, avoidance, vindictive zeal, genuine curiosity, and joie de vivre that the performance becomes what Larry loves, a buffet. Also, what a liar. And yet, who else in the last quarter century has done more to insist on some standard of alternative etiquette to speak to the humiliating, exasperating paradoxes of doing just about anything in the 21st century of America? Larry's plight is ours. His struggle with gratuities and plastic packaging and stop and chats, never to be mistaken for the chat and cut, with dinner party conversation, appropriate in-flight attire, social slights and trick or treaters, with behaving neighborly, compassionately, with spills and stains and rashes, snags, dents, nicks, knocks, his, yours. Larry's confusion about greetings and salutations, about language itself, would crowd an hours-long supercut. Who else in his attempts to do good or simply enjoy himself has stood as thoroughly misunderstood, maligned, and stamped pervert, racist, sexist, sick by strangers, friends, their wives, potential mistresses, fundamental Muslims, fellow Jews? This, then, is to say that Larry's struggle is also Larry's. He's the apotheosis of unforced era, a person for whom the expression, "Where do you get off?" is eternally meant. The show constitutes a behavioral gestalt. It stress tests our understanding of how to treat one another and what not to ask, how not to act. Until a few weeks ago, I wouldn't have thought to put it quite this way. But Larry David is Emily Post. He's Amy Vanderbilt. The show is, and in quotes, Larry David's complete book of etiquette, his ungraciously gracious guide to living. Curb Your Enthusiasm began in 2000 when TV functioned the old way, on a fixed schedule and network dominated. The top shows still included ER, Friends, and Everybody Loves Raymond. Expensive, scripted, written, performed. Curb Your Enthusiasm ran on HBO after The Sopranos, a drama that conducted itself with the grittiness and opulence of a major film. Early Curb episodes are like a bad independent movie, shakily shot on washed-out video, too tightly framed, misscored, haltingly active. It was a world away from The Sopranos, an anti-production. But that unkept, feral quality was the source of the show's allure. Its episodes are improvised and tend to exceed the 30-minute mark that's still the limit for a network sitcom. The on-the-spot approach to creating comedy brings it closer to the raw timber of documentary. Its wildness matched the chaos brewing around us. That first season wrapped up during the hazy fury that followed the 2000 presidential election. Episode 5 aired the Sunday after Election Day and conducts itself in rancorous spasms. At his doctor's office, Larry makes the gentlemanly choice of letting a woman off the elevator before he exits. It's part of his You First era. But even though Larry has an earlier appointment, the doctor's first-come, first-served policy means she gets seen before he does, arousing Larry's spite. "My days of elevator etiquette are over," he declares. Everybody in the episode wields a policy of some kind, for reading scripts, for borrowing cash from strangers, for giving out phone numbers. Their values clash, sometimes violently, with Larry's. You might be looking for trouble, marrying Curb Your Enthusiasm to a political climate, but politics do suffuse the show. They're social and correspondent with the new century's choleric base layer. There's no one whom Larry won't go up against. Seniors, Girl Scouts, Lin-Manuel Miranda. Most of the show's run occurred during the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. If war, national security, recession, police killings of Black Americans, fraying democracy, hate crimes, and a pandemic were tearing the country apart, belligerents look different within the world of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Its vision sidestepped sweeping philosophy. It rarely sought bigger fish to fry, nor was it ever content to shoot them in a barrel. As Americans' distrust in unifying systems, like the truth and the social safety net, ballooned, as we grew more trollish, more righteous, more tolerant of tumult, and of the dissolution of certain rules, the show didn't waver. It luxuriated in the bawdy, tactless, and loony. For God's sakes, its theme song conjures a clown circus suite. Whoopee cushion tuba, banana peel woodwinds. The headlines, when they perforate this fiction, wind up being beneath its big top. This isn't so much a matter of the show zagging when the national mood zigs, although there is that. It's a pointed acknowledgement that most of us have no idea what the national news is, let alone the mood. We do know that it's Tuesday, which means alternate side parking. which means doing etiquette battle in the street. For gaseous macrocosmic poli-sci, people can turn to Aaron Sorkin. For gripes about the stale array of doctor's office magazines, there has been Larry. Nonetheless, this show couldn't help capturing attention in our ideas of propriety. In sampling, I don't know, 7 flavors of ice cream, consider it when Larry's right behind you. How about 2? Divisive stuff. The show identified a shift in comportment towards shamelessness. The character actor Robin Bartlett, who plays the 7th flavor sampler, when Larry tells her off, Bartlett conjures more than unfazed. When he says, "Seriously, another sample?" As she makes her exit, having almost villainously settled on vanilla, she is tickled by his rage. The show's disharmony over not nothing, over what for Tuesday can be everything, was onto and up to something. It understood the cheap delight some of us take in eliciting exasperation. By 2000, television protagonists were undergoing a nearly identical makeover that prized antagonism, a transition lubricated by Seinfeld, the sitcom David helped create. It ended 2 years earlier, and on Curb is the reason Larry enjoys some celebrity and is set for life. We call the new archetypes antiheroes. Only Larry's brand of anti-heroism, insolence, disregard for people's wishes, cries out for an adjacent designation, one that honors his rudeness, his monomania, his unsolicited 2 cents, both his indifference to and pleasure in the sour reactions his behavior sometimes garners. Larry is an asshole. This is scarcely news in Lar-Lar land. You could compose another extended supercut of the number of times the show's other characters have stamped him with that. Well, that's it for this week's reading of the New York Times Magazine. I've been reading from the April 7th, 2024 issue. I'm Frankie Goldfarb. Have a great day, and thanks for listening to Chris.